kind of a roller coaster ride of a show today, wouldn't you say?
A little bit, a little bit. Yeah. Ups and downs.
Yeah. We started off the program talking about what is happening on our college campuses. It is insane. And we kind of end the show in the same kind of spirit. We had a rabbi come in from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He's a great guy, great friend. He just got back from Israel, and we talked about how the world is splitting in light and dark, good and evil, or choose life or choose death. Don't want to miss that really, really good hour with him. And then we also went over the voting machines and what's happening in the 2024 election. This is probably the most important 45 minutes that you could spend today, bringing yourself up to speed on what can be done to shore up the elections and pass that on to a friend. And of course, Stu had an update on the bloody horses that were running through the streets of London, but not really. Strangely, we still don't really know why one of them was covered in blood. But we'll have all of that and so much more on today's podcast. Here it is. First, trust is in really short supply these days. Taking some time to really think about that. You know, maybe there was never really any good old days when, you know, everybody you met was good and upstanding citizen. You could trust in a handshake. But at least there used to be more of them, it seems. But is that entirely true? I'm not sure. Sometimes when you set out to find, and you're good people, trying to find good people, you'll find it's like you're a beacon. And we have found so many great real estate agents. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com is my company. And this is one of the biggest, hardest, and emotional decisions you're ever going to make, is selling and buying a house. And right now, it is really complex and dicey. So you need the best real estate agent. Could we pair you up with one today? At least give you the opportunity to interview them. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, or even if you just have questions, they're going to have the person for the job at realestateagentsitrust.com. You just contact us, tell us where you're moving from and to, what you're looking for, and we will pair you up if we have one in your area. We don't always have one in your area. We don't just recommend anybody. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. That's RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
There is an ancient evil that is sweeping the world. And we have seen it before. Yesterday, our college campuses were on fire. New York, California, police being backed up into corners. Some people being arrested. Strangely, not in Texas. A&M was almost a war zone. The governor comes out and says, we will not tolerate anti-Semitism. But the world is tolerating anti-Semitism. And most of these college students really have no idea what they're even protesting.
And what would you say is the main goal with tonight's protest?
I think the goal is just showing our support for Palestine and demanding that NYU stop. I honestly don't know
okay.
what NYU is doing.
Is there something that NYU is doing?
I really don't know. I'm pretty sure they're... Okay. Do you know what NYU is doing?
About what?
About Israel. Why are we protesting here?
Why are we even protesting? This has happened before. Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s.
It's not only reminiscent of what happened in Germany in the 1930s. It happened here in America. It was February 20th, 1939. Hitler was building his sixth concentration camp. He was about to go into Poland. And on the streets of Manhattan, Americans gathered to salute the flag at Madison Square Garden.
I pledge undivided allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Speaker after speaker came and stood in front of giant portraits of George Washington with the Nazi symbol.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, American patriots, I'm sure I do not come before you tonight as a complete stranger. You all have heard of me through the Jewish-controlled press as a creature with horns, a cloven hoof, and a long tail. We, with American ideals, demand that our government shall be returned to the American people who founded it.
And of course, he sounds just like one of our founders, doesn't he?
What we are actively fighting for under our charter. First, a social just white Gentile ruled United States.
A socially just white Gentile United States. This has happened before in America, and it's happening again. There is one guy who has written an article that I saw, I think, yesterday or the day before from Semaphore. He's a national political reporter. David Weigel is with us. And the pro-Palestinian protesters have all started to mask up. Now, why would they do that? David, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So why are they masking up? They're wearing, you know, COVID masks, N95 masks.
They are, and I heard two reasons for this, and I printed both of these reasons. Not everyone I called got back to me, but one was that on the left, I'd say more than anywhere else in the country, there still is a belief that you need to mask up to protect from COVID, you need to mask up to protect other people from who might have comorbidities, et cetera. It's always May 2020. That's a belief that's out there, but the National Lawyers Guild, which is sort of the left's legal advice clinic, which operates around the country, and other people on the left have said it is important to cover your face to avoid facial recognition, to avoid being doxxed, you know, to be in a photo and somebody looks up who you are and says, please fire this person. They've been advising that for years, and they started advising that after 2020 because there were lots of anti-mask laws on the books to prevent people from concealing their identities, and those laws were lifted or changed or halted because of the guidance that Anthony Fauci and others put in place in 2020.
So some of these people, I mean, these are the people that are going to be leading the world at some point. These are the quote best and brightest in our universities, and there is reason to believe that they don't want to be known because they won't be able to get a job.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you've seen enough videos of people talking to reporters at these protests, often maybe a reporter from a more conservative outlet who students don't want to talk to, you might see this dissonance, right? There are people who have decided to go out in the public space, be part of something big, be part of something historic with cameras literally surrounding them. I mean, everyone has a camera phone, and they don't want to go on camera, share their identity, take a mask off. I have encountered that for years covering right and left protests. And from January 6th, Baltimore riots, I've covered a lot of this stuff. The attitude is generally that You want to be part, you want to loan your body, I would say, to a mass demonstration, but you don't necessarily want to put your face in front of it because you might be exposed. That is the idea, that a mass movement does not mean that every single person is going to have an A&E biography written about them or filmed about them. It is, my body is here because I'm here, because 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 people are here. It's hard for the police, it's hard for our opposition to resist us. And so hiding from cameras, the media, et cetera, that isn't contradictory. That is you are still doing social justice if you personally don't want to have your name attached to it and your face attached to it.
So you brought up January 6th. And, you know, what happened on January 6th was a nightmare and horrible. And I want everybody who broke a window, did damage, all of this stuff, threatening people, I want them all to go to jail, correctly and justly be tried and go to jail. You never hear anyone separate the good people from the bad people here. And I'm wondering how many of these protesters even have a clue as to what they're saying. How many of them even know what the river to the sea means?
Well, that's a question. Usually you show up and ask people, can you define this term? And again, you often encounter people who don't want to be in a gotcha game on camera, on a recorder, talking about this because they want to be part of something bigger. I can't psychoanalyze for every single person who's taking part in one of these protests. But that attitude is there. And I think in coverage of this, you're starting to see, not to get too meta because I'm covering it too, you're starting to see the negative impact of this. There are people at a protest. The people who are most bold about going out there, not using a mask, getting a bullhorn, saying slogans, they're often part of groups like the Party for Socialism or Liberation, the Revolutionary Communist Party. They're people who are very drilled, who are already on every watch list or already on the FBI's watch list, and will say things like, here is a slogan for you to chant, and the slogan means death to Israel, or here is a pro-Hamas flag that I'm waving. They are next to people who might just, you know, they have, I'm not trying to be too patronizing, but they might have a different view of things, or they just would like a ceasefire in Israel, and they decided to go walk and join this protest because that seems to be the way to get it. I mean, you made January, I mentioned January 6th, you mentioned it. Were there people who showed up at protests, at Stop the Steal protests, and were angry about the election, then went home? There were. There were also people who showed up and said they wanted to overthrow the government. There were people who showed up at Black Lives Matter protests, I covered some of them in 2020, who said, yes, I'd like more police reform. And then they went home. But the people with the megaphones were saying, and we want to overthrow capitalism and abolish prisons and police, right? So I think by concealing their identities, that has exacerbated the role that the more radical voices have in this movement. And you see the backlash. You see the way that, I'm just describing things without justifying them. You're seeing the way that these protests are responded to by police, by governors, etc. They're responding to the very vocal anti-Israel sentiments, anti-Zionist, sometimes anti-Semitic, sometimes murderous sentiments they're hearing from people who do show up and say, here I am, here's who I am, here's what I believe. And it is something, that will offend 95% of the country or more.
How long do you think this lasts? I mean, is this something that dies out? I mean, I always thought the Occupy Wall Street thing would die out faster than it did. And I think they actually had a huge impact. I think those banks and those corporations saw that they were being disrupted and went, okay, well, we'll throw you some money your way and support your way. Just leave us alone. Is this real staying power, and how big is this movement in America?
It has grown, but it's harder to quantify because this has been happening in places with Democratic politicians, in college towns, on college campuses. There are parts of the country you can drive for 100 miles, you're not seeing anyone talk or put up a sign about this conflict. But if you're Joe Biden, you go raise money in West LA or Ann Arbor, et cetera, you're going to be surrounded by people for whom this is the defining issue. So how much has it grown? Hard question. Now, the sentiment against funding the war, funding aid to Israel as it wages this war in Gaza, that has collapsed. That's sort of the paradox here. you look at polling for how many Americans want there to be the funding bill that was passed in the last week. It's lower than the share of Americans who supported the Vietnam War at this point in 1870. And I bring up Vietnam because not they haven't mentioned enough things, but a lot of protesters see themselves as heirs to that sort of anti-war movement, heirs to the people who showed up, protested the war, willing to get arrested, in some cases were shot. And yes, they are willing, that side of the movement is willing to just keep protesting, keep getting arrested, keep doing disobedience, as long as the war is going on. Some of them, I would say, and I used to separate, some of them for as long as Israel exists. You could go to a left-wing protest when nothing was, when there was a ceasefire, there wasn't Antifada, nothing was happening in Israel. There would be people calling for the end of the Jewish state to be replaced by Palestine. That's been there for decades. But this level of intensity and this sort of organizing, this is the motivator that is getting half the population of the Ivy League out onto the campus and protesting. I think that is tied to how long this war goes on. If there is a ceasefire, I would assume that a lot of the people I've been talking about, people who are showing up and protesting and don't necessarily want to be identified but are not radicals, those people I think would go home based on my experience and what happened with a protest in the past. And if you look at, you can see protests shrink over time, how many people are showing up to this because they're worried about being exposed or because they think that they might have believed in part of this cause, but it went too far for them. I think that would happen at some point. I don't think anything changes as long as this war is going on. That's the terminator. I mean, that's how Wall Street broke up for a number of reasons, but capitalism was still there. The banks were still there. The system they were protesting was still there. This war, not to overcomplicate things, this war is defining these protests. When the war is over, there still will be a movement, a smaller movement, that is agitating for just the destruction of the current state of Israel. And I think their numbers will have increased, but they're not going to be able to amass crowds like they are right now.
David, thank you so much for watching this. Thanks for your really insightful The Rise of the Mask is Israel Gaza Protester. I you just picked up on something I don't think anybody did.
I was surprised too.
I know.
I was the first one to put it out. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You bet. You can read it at semaphore.com, semaphore.com. David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
You know the old line from the commercials, there's got to be a better way. It was almost always used to sell you a product you didn't need for a problem you didn't have. There's got to be a better way. What about a product that you could use for a problem that you do have? In this case, pain. If you've lived with pain like I have for a long time, you've tried absolutely everything. You might indeed be saying to yourself, there's got to be a better way. That's why your announcer is here to tell you Relief Factor. Relief Factor isn't a drug. It's a daily supplement that helps your body fight pain by fighting inflammation, and it's 100% drug-free. Listen to the people who have taken it. You know, I had really bad pain in my hands for a long time. I couldn't even paint. Then I started taking Relief Factor. I can use my hands again. It's people like this that use Relief Factor. Try it for their 3-week quick start, only $19.95. Visit relieffactor.com or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. 1-800-4-RELIEF, relieffactor.com. Now back to the podcast. You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program. Rabbi Yitzhak Alderstein is with us now from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He is the Director of Interfaith Affairs. He is one of my favorite people on earth. Rabbi, good to have you.
Great to be here.
Yeah. You just got back from Israel.
Correct.
How are things?
You know, we say in Israel, kumo kolonu, like everybody else. That's it says a lot. It means that we're going through some hard times, but we're still remarkably united. There's some signs of things fracturing a little, but it's a minority of the country.
Were you there for the response from Iran?
There? It was a night of biblical meaning. I was one of the overly naive people who actually believed the reports from the media when they first came in. They've launched, they're on their way, but they're only going to hit two places in the country. So unless you're at an Air Force base in the Negev or sitting on the Golan, hey, it should be okay. So I actually went to sleep. There weren't too many people who went to sleep. to be awakened at 2 a.m. by the sirens. And my wife saying, we got to get downstairs to the bomb shelter. And we
what is
did.
That like to live like that?
It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant. But I had steeled myself to it before. I figured I'd rather die with my boots on, figuratively, in most of the country, not figuratively, and die with pride as a Jew in God's land than cower in Brooklyn. Mm. And we went downstairs. We had some guests over as well, and we waited a couple of minutes, and hey, nothing happened. And then we get the all clear. Hey, this was kind of like, anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And we went upstairs, and then, just like figured we'd look outside, and went outside. We have a beautiful view from our porch in Jerusalem, and treated to a light show like it was 4th of July.
You said it was biblical. Let's see if we're on the same page. It felt, at least to me, like a just divine protection, the hand of God just putting a dome over Israel.
How
crazy.
Else do you get a 99% rate of taking those things down? We know that there is human inaccuracy. Look, anybody who plays video games knows that you don't always get those incoming.
Right.
Right? And any one of those could have done damage. And then a few days later, after we sustain almost no damage at all with one injury in a Bedouin village, a couple of days later, we finally respond to Iran and don't lob anything like those numbers there. And they hit the munitions factory right next door to a nuclear installation and blow it up.
I got to tell you that what was done in Syria, you're in a town in Syria and there are buildings right next to buildings and you hit with a missile one and that collapsed and seemingly no damage anywhere else. It's incredible how accurate things are happening with Israel.
Right. And those who are believers don't attribute that to the might of the IDF. We're very, very, very grateful to the IDF, especially to the soldiers. But they got October 7th wrong. And there have been lots of friendly fire casualties because human error is always involved. And there wasn't here. To those who are believers, this was as close to a Cecil B. DeMille moment as we were going to get in our lifetime.
Yeah. Forgive me for not knowing the eschatology of Jews, but there's many Christians who believe we're living in the times for the return of the Messiah. I know Iran believes that they're looking for the return of the promised one, the 12th Imam, and which gives them a real bloodthirst at this point. What do people in Israel feel about the Messiah?
Look, we've been waiting for a couple of thousand years, and we pray every day, and we don't hope for the Messiah to come.
Right. No,
we know he's coming.
Yeah.
We know he's coming. Jews and Christians share that. We don't hope for a better world. It's guaranteed. God's word is money in the bank. Whether we're living in those times, there are hints of it. I'm a little bit on the conservative side, so I try not to set ourselves up for disappointment. But there's one thing in the Talmud that that strikes me. The Talmud says that one of the indications that you're on the verge or in the footsteps of the Messiah is that the generation of it is, they're no fence sitters. You're either on one side or you're on the other. And we are so close. So we really got there on October 8th, when you have half of the people in the world, I hope it's half the people in the world, or still hundreds of millions who said, this is moral depravity. If this can't be called not only evil, but barbaric and demonic, then nothing is. And other people are saying, well, really, nothing is. It's all context, or you guys brought it about. Or what do you expect? So the world, not just the small corner of it, and not just America, But the world has divided itself up into people who have room to understand morality and those who've rejected it and see everything as relative.
Do you see in the rest of the world, I don't even want to know the answer to this. Hopefully you see a difference in Christians. The Jews see a difference in Christians this time around, from the last time, but, we are only seeing the bad stuff. When you go over to Europe, are you seeing Christians and others surprisingly maybe standing up?
I'm surprised at the hesitation in your asking that question. 100%. We're conscious in Israel that the only reliable allies we have on the face of the earth are Christians, are serious Bible-believing Christians, to be more specific. And then there are good people all over. I came back not so long ago from Berlin. My youngest son lives in Berlin. He's on the faculty of a rabbinical school in Berlin. He lives across the street from the synagogue and community center and school where his kids go that was firebombed a couple of months ago, right? So ever since the time that it was firebombed, a group of people, mostly Christian, believing Christian, come every Friday night to
stand guard
as a vigil for the people. And these are just locals. They're not bussed in from other parts of Berlin. Locals in the neighborhood. Yes, there are people. There are good people. There are good people all over. I can point to Palestinian friends as well.
You know, I'm shocked because when I go over to Israel, and I'll talk to Palestinians. I don't go into Gaza, but when I talk to Palestinians who are living in Israel, if the cameras are off, they will always say, oh, I would much rather, I have a much better time in Israel than over in Gaza. I live next door to the Jews and we're fine. But once the camera is on, you don't hear that very often. And they're afraid. They're afraid to say that. Now, in Gaza, the ones who have been raised on this poison, I mean...
sort of like students in America who have been raised on a different kind of poison.
Yeah.
It's not all that different.
So what do you do? You know, you can't put a fire out. You can't put 80% of a fire out and then go, we're just going to take a break. We didn't stop in Germany with the Nazis. You cannot have you can't have anything other than, okay. And then you still have to go through the community and find those that were leaders of it. And Nuremberg, please tell me that Israel is committed to, no matter what the world says, finishing this job, because that's the only shot we have.
The majority of the country is committed to that very, very strongly. There definitely is a minority that's wavering.
Is it kind of the Tel Aviv kind of crowd?
Yeah, the Tel Aviv kind of crowd, and some of the old time leftists, and some of the old brass of the army, which is very reluctantly giving up control to a younger generation, which is much more committed, much more focused.
I don't know. It would be so frustrating. It's frustrating to live in America right now. It would be so frustrating to have the bombs actually raining down and what happened on October 7th and then sit next to somebody who's like, yeah, I think we should give it a pause. It would be hard. What can we do to help? What can this audience do to help? What do Jews here in America need? And what do Jews in Israel need?
Well, that's a bunch of questions. Jews in Israel are enormously buoyed up by shows of support from the rest of the world. On the one hand, we're prepared to go it alone. What we've done, what the events of the last months, preceded by a couple of decades, have done is to produce a Gen Z in Israel, which is the polar opposite of what we have here in the United States. We're talking about kids who, when they're 18, 19, learn to live together, to cooperate in the army, learn that they have a national mission, that they work for others and for community, and now they've had a practicum in what it means to translate that into reality and see the reaction of the rest of the world. So we're prepared, and we have the strength to go at it. And whatever God decides is the outcome, you know, we'll live with it, or die with it. But it is so comforting to know that it's not the entire world that has turned against us, that there are good people all over, almost exclusively people who believe in Abrahamic monotheism.
Yeah. Do you have a theory on why this keeps happening?
People have been coming up with theories about anti-Semitism for thousands of years. The only theories that resonate with me is that Jews stand for something that consciously or subconsciously much of the world resists, which is a connection between man and God, a people committed to a mission of making God's will something real. Even Jews who are not observant still stand for that biblical message. And that message is more than a lot of people can take. Hitler supposedly said it best. He said that there are two things that we can never forgive the Jews for: circumcision and conscience. That's a powerful statement.
This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Podcast. To hear more of this interview, check out the full episode anywhere podcasts are found.
This is what happened
recently made
last
aware
night
of an alleged vulnerability in the Dominion voting systems. It was mentioned in a federal court case. I have to tell you, I didn't even know how to begin to have a discussion on this, but I'll start with this. We are not accusing Dominion of anything. We are not saying that this alleged vulnerability has ever been used or existed. In fact, I've got been there, done that, got the t-shirt. I have another t-shirt for you. We're not even saying that this will be used to manipulate the next election. We are doing one thing. We are highlighting something that was alleged in a federal court. We haven't seen anyone dispute it or even talk about the alleged vulnerability. Now, it shouldn't matter what side you're on. It shouldn't matter if you work for Dominion or any other voting machine company. You, me, everyone, we all want a secure election. We want there to be confidence on all sides when we vote. Talking about potential issues gets us closer to those goals. And asking questions used to be something that both the left and the right agreed together that we should be doing. I want to show you a transcript of a conversation on PBS regarding Georgia's voting machines. Two of the experts, Alex Halderman and Hari Hursti, said that they were potential vulnerabilities that attackers could take advantage of. Hursti said that Georgia's system was complicated, and it doesn't seem to have any safeguards. If you're curious, Georgia's system is Dominion, the same system mentioned in the recent petition. Now, the alleged vulnerability is different, but here they are all freely talking about it. Take a look at this transcript. It was October 2020. Why was it okay for both sides to talk about it then, but hardly anyone will do it now? Harry Hursti is somewhat of a legend in the community that searches for vulnerabilities in electronic voting systems. He was featured in an HBO documentary explaining how he hacked a Diebold voting machine back in 2005 using a single memory card. I'll tell you the results of that hack later on in the program. But that election system, Diebold, was later bought in 2010 by Dominion. We don't know if this software is still in use, but the HBO documentary website mentioned that, as of several years ago, it was. Still used or not used? There is an interesting history here. The other expert featured in that PBS piece was Alex Halderman. Last year, he was given access, last year, to the Georgia Dominion voting machines to see if he could find any vulnerabilities. And he did. Halderman found Dominion's machines in Georgia are, quote, critically vulnerable to hacking, vulnerable to vote switching. Dominion countered that the hack was unrealistic, but federal authorities found the same vulnerabilities, and more than 20 cybersecurity experts backed up Halderman's findings. Now, there was never any evidence that this was taken advantage of in an election. The worry is that this could be abused in future elections. So this is actually a good story. Everyone seems to be in agreement that the hack is possible, and we know about it in advance. So it should be easily fixed, right? All you have to do is upgrade the system before November, and it's over. Well, not so fast. Quote, some of the issues could be mitigated by upgrading the Dominion software, but Georgia officials say the upgrade is unrealistic, an enormous undertaking they won't start until after the 2024 elections. What? I mean, I hate to say that this gives the appearance that they're not taking the election security seriously. That's quite a quote. I only point out these recent vulnerabilities to show you that they have been found before, and that not only that, but the experts and the media used to talk about them all the time. I don't want to look backward. The past is the past, but we must fix the system if there's a problem. There was one specific allegation in the court documents that caught my eye. It was so technical and specific, I hadn't seen it anywhere. But this is an excerpt from the lawsuit that describes the alleged vulnerability. This is public, and that's one reason why we wanted to do this show. You can read this for yourself, but I have to warn you. The nerd speak sounds like a mixture of Greek combined with Japanese. This is not something anyone and everyone could do. Luckily, I have my nerd speaker decoder ring. In a nutshell, here's what it describes. It describes how Dominion's democracy suite systems encrypt their data. An encryption key is needed to access the critical data. Some call it the God key. It should be kept encrypted itself. But in the allegation described in the lawsuit, it claims that on some Dominion machines, it's not. The allegation claims that the encryption key can easily be secured for on the system and that the only security safeguard is logging into Windows. This petition that makes this claim from March claims that a malicious actor could use this to, quote, gain total access and control over an election, end quote. When you go to vote and you get a ballot, you mark your selections at the voting machine. Then when you're finished, the machine prints the vote. You take that to a tabulator. An election official scans the ballot into the tabulator and records your vote. The information is later saved to a memory card, and that is taken to a computer. That computer is where this alleged vulnerability is claimed to be. How many people in the election office have access to that computer? What if the only guy with the key in that office is malicious? What if someone broke in? Now, clearly, this does not appear to be something that anyone could pull off. People without the proper skill could not do this. I couldn't do this. But what's being alleged would take some expertise, but appears that maybe. The court filing described this alleged vulnerability as, quote, a bank telling the public that they have the most secure vault in the world and then taping the combination of the vault on the wall next to the door. I'm going to show you some video here and some long disclaimers. Why don't you take the disclaimer? Because we asked a cybersecurity expert with knowledge of this allegation to attempt to recreate what was described in the court case. Could they do it? We asked them if they could use the same Dominion software and then asked if they could screen record the entire process. So they did. Disclaimer, and then I think we have another disclaimer coming up. Yeah, so an additional disclaimer. Okay. This is the Microsoft admin computer. So you would log in here, put your password in, it would open up to this, then you would go into the tabulation. Okay. Database does not require additional password once a viewer is logged into Windows. Okay, we're fine. All of this up there, it's all encrypted, you see? But the encryption keys are stored in this table right here in plain text. So they take the keys, this is the key to the main vault, and you cut and paste. You put the last one over here. Now watch what happens. When you put the keys in, here's the last one. This is what happens. All encrypted, you see, there's no information. Now you can decrypt the election files using the extracted keys and a few lines of code. Open. There's the encryption. Now using the keys, a description script is executed. And now I have the names. I have everything that I need. It's now decrypted. It's the knock list. It's out in the open. A user can run a script to re-encrypt it if they wanted to make any changes. The conclusion from the expert, with no password and just a few minutes with an election server, an individual can access the keys to the election. That is stunning. Let me play one more thing because I brought John Graves in last night. We went to the chalkboard and I said, just so people understand what I just showed you, look at this. So I want to make sure that we have this right and everybody understands.
Yes.
Okay. The election, the voting machine is like a bank.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. Okay. Great analogy.
And to get in to the front door, you need a key. Who would have that key? All the commissioners?
Yeah, a Dominion employee, a county commissioner, they would either have it or have authority. Anybody who can access the database has the PC login key.
Okay, so that's a Windows PC, right?
There you go. Yes.
And it's all normal, and you just sign in.
Username and password, and you put the password
in. And it opens the door of the bank.
And you're in the bank lobby.
Right. But you should not be able to open the vault.
No, you should not.
Okay.
With the key to the bank.
Right. Okay. So you have the key to the, and all commissioners have this, and that's normal.
Yeah. Right. Right, yeah.
But in the lobby of the bank,
that's right,
in the open are the four keys that open the vault.
That's right.
So what can you do in the vault with the four keys?
Yeah, so the allegations that were made in this lawsuit, yeah, that you pointed out, these keys could shut off the cameras and wipe that you were there because they're encryption keys. They could take the gold and replace it with counterfeit gold, take the cash, replace it with counterfeit cash. You would never know it. And then literally go right back out and no one would know that you're there. You showed that on the demonstration,
right,
of the cybersecurity expert.
That's not good.
No, it's not good at all. Okay. That's why it alarmed me.
All right. So we're going to go through this just a little bit more. And then the most important part, what do we do? This audience could play a very big role in saving the republic, but it's going to take your time. It's not hard. It's really not hard, but we all have to do it because this is really kind of happening through us. And so you have to spread the word because there may be 10 million people listening, but you know, that's not enough. We need everybody to be aware of this.